Now, the first picture I wanted to show you is this one. And some people, especially if you live in a corporate world, will have heard of the modern parable of the management consultant and the fisherman. I'm looking for twinkles of recognition. No, not so many. It's a story that gets bandied about. It's about a management consultant. He goes on holiday somewhere a bit like this to a sleepy fishing village, and he notices that the fisherman completes his work in 1 hour. And then he goes off and he spends the rest of his day with his family, and then in the evening he goes out and he plays in a band and hangs out with his friends. And the consultant sees this, and he immediately knows what to say. And he goes up to him, and as he's wandering up the beach, and he says, "Look, I've got an MBA, and therefore I can show you how to improve your life. If you fished all day, before long you would have enough yield to buy a fleet of boats. And eventually you could move to the city, you could run a fish distribution business, and after a couple of decades you could sell shares in your business and possibly have enough even to retire." "And after that?" asked the fisherman. "Well, after that you could move out to a fishing village where you could fish in the morning and spend the rest of the day with your family and spend the evenings playing in your band and hanging out with your friends." And of course the fisherman smiles at the guy, shakes his head and carries on walking. And of course the point of the story is that it's meant to poke fun at our society's obsession with gain that we've been thinking about in our first session, the obsession with productivity, and especially the way it is ruining our lives and making us as a society into super busy stress heads. And so the question we're thinking about in this session is, why are we so busy? Why are we so stressed? And it's particularly odd, isn't it, given how many labour-saving devices we now have. We have washing machines. We even have supermarket deliveries, so that jobs which would have taken our forebears the best part of a week now literally take us minutes. So why is it that we are busier than ever? And people suggest that the technology, things like mobile phones, actually make things worse for us. We're now under greater pressure to reply immediately, and we can never leave our work behind. Researchers now try and quantify just how busy we are by average pedestrian speeds. Have you come across this? We're now walking 10% faster in London even than 20 years ago. Presumably because we're in more of a hurry and we're even more stressed than we were. And I think it's this kind of backdrop, this kind of situation that means Ecclesiastes 3 is peculiarly relevant to us. Because it pushes back and it says that so much of our frantic busyness actually comes from misunderstanding God's role and our role in life. One of the big themes in Ecclesiastes is forcing us to see life as it truly is, life warts and all, and then showing us what it would mean to live wisely and joyfully in the midst of all that. So let's get into the passage. You'll see from our sheets the first point the writer wants us to see is this one on the sheets, that the seasons of life are beyond our control. And you'll remember this passage begins with that beautiful poem. Let me read from verse 1. "For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal." And it goes on. And many of us will be familiar, even if we don't know Ecclesiastes, we'll know the Bob Dylan song, or we'll have come across this poem somewhere else. It's a famous poem. And what I love about this poem is that it's so beautifully ambiguous. We read it, we don't quite know what to do with it. Is it good news? Is it bad news? Is it positive? Is it negative? And there's clues both ways. We're told at the start that there is a time for every matter under heaven. And the fact that it's under heaven rather than under sun, which is the phrase we've mainly had until now. We've had it 8 times. Hints that this is very significantly under God's good governance. Heaven is referred to as the place where God dwells in chapter 5. So it seems positive. And the poem we're told, has 14 pairs of times. As you may know, 7 and its multiples is used in the Bible to symbolise perfection. God made the world in 7 days. It's another positive. And the poem reminds us of the magnificent rhythms of the natural world, which this book of Ecclesiastes began with back in chapter 1, 4-7. The sun rises and the sun goes down. And then here it's with human activity, a time to be born and a time to die. So there are some clues here which should lead us to think it's a positive poem. But then when we read the first comment at the end of the poem, it takes us, I think, in a very different direction. Look at verse 9. This will be familiar from reading up to this point this morning. What gain has the worker from his toil? Verse 10. I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. And this business which God gives to be busy with is the unhappy business of futility, which comes from living in a cursed world. And we came across that business first in chapter 1:13. It's a negative idea. It's an unhappy business, 1:13, that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. And from that perspective, we then read the poem quite negatively. And we read it again, and we go back and we notice that there really is no gain in the poem. Have a look, for example, verse 5. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. It's almost comically unproductive. It's, you know, there really is nothing to show from a day that you gather them and then scatter them. But it's not just unproductive, it's also out of our control. And this is another thing which is developed in the comments afterwards. These seasons of life mostly are things which happen to us without our planning. For example, verse 2, we don't choose when is a time to be born. None of us chose that. And most of us don't choose when is a time to die. We don't choose, most of us, when it's a time for war, verse 8, or a time for peace. Even down to our emotional responses, verse 4, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. It's not just that we don't control when someone dies, we don't even control how long it might take to grieve them. Life just is mainly out of control, out of our control. And apart from the first pair, which arguably do work very well as an opener, there's no discernible structure for the other pairs. Just like with life, it just things get thrown at us, seemingly randomly. It's out of control. So what are we meant to do with this poem? Is it positive? Is it negative? And I think it's the ambiguity that is precisely the point of it. Because you see, this poem describes life as we experience it, life as it truly is. It is what living in this world feels like. And actually, whether you and I receive that as good or bad depends on us and our own outlook. So yes, the seasons of life are beyond our control. And therefore, if we are control freaks, if we're obsessed with the question of where is gain, verse 9, then this poem, like the seasons of life, will feel oppressive to us. These things are just getting in the way of my plans. Everything here is hampering my productivity. And yet if, as the writer wants to show us, there is a Lord of time, and if there is a God who is good and who is generous and can be trusted, then the fact that life is out of our control might possibly be good news. And that brings us neatly... Oh, there were the seasons of life. I'm not very good with these. That brings us on to our second point. The seasons of life are beyond our control, but wonderfully we can trust the Lord of time. That question in verse 9, what gain has the worker from his toil, is the one we've seen Solomon's been interested in right since the beginning of the book. And it's almost identical to the question we started with, wasn't it, in chapter 1, verse 3. What gain, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? And then verse 10 reminds us of what Solomon's already revealed, that since our first parents rebelled, God has deliberately frustrated this world. Verse 10 we saw, I have seen the business, the frustrating, fruitless business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. But next, there is going to be some new teaching about how, despite our inability to understand, our inability to control the seasons of life, there is one who can, the God who is Lord over time. Look at verse 11. He, which is God, has made everything beautiful in its time. And that phrase, beautiful in its time, it has the sense of beautifully fitting. It's like a well-crafted story. Now, we may not understand why one particular season of life follows from another. Why, for example, 2017 has gone in a different direction from what I planned it to, or why, you know, such and such has scuppered our goals and plans. But God knows why that has happened. He crafted it perfectly. And of course, if we had his perspective, then we could see that every scene in life has its perfect place. Verse 11. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from beginning to end. And this verse explains why human beings feel the tension that we do in life. We know that there is some big picture. All humans sense that there's an enduring significance to this world and to what happens in it. There's an eternity in our hearts. Incidentally, that's why people speak, don't they, about how things like love and justice matter. They're not just opinions. People know they're realities, they're absolutes. Even though often people's worldviews can't always support what they know deep down. But the verse says, whilst we know enough to realise there is an eternity, that we and our actions do have significance, lasting significance, the point here is that we don't see enough to understand what the big picture is. We don't see enough to see how all the scenes that we're in contribute to the whole. And it's frustrating. At one time when I was on holiday with my family as a teenager, we went to Spain and we visited Salvador Dali's house in Figueres, and it's packed with his art. And it's a gallery now, and when you walk in along a balcony, you see an 18-meter high painting called Gala, Looking at the Sea. And it's a slightly odd painting. It's blocky, it's puzzling. And you see it and you think, that's really big. I wonder what it's about. And you keep walking. And then later, a little bit later, if you keep walking around the gallery, you find yourself in the main hall looking up at that same picture, but this time from a distance. And there it is up on the balcony. And if you squint right now, you might notice something strange about the picture. Can anyone tell me what's odd about it? Abraham Lincoln. Yeah, that's right. It's drawn deliberately to be, from a distance, a portrait of the American president, Abraham Lincoln. And the woman's blocky head is actually Abraham Lincoln's eye. You'll have to check this out online afterwards, because if I'll show you, there's the head. Hold that, that becomes his eye, and so on. And the orange weird sunset becomes his Abraham Lincoln's forehead, and so on. And at last, once later, as you're going around the gallery, you suddenly realise that what was a bit blocky and weird now makes sense. But there's no way you could have known what it was actually about when you were up close to it. Only the artist knew what each of the details in the picture was really put there for, each of the little blocks. And Solomon is saying here that that is our experience of life. Our experience of life is as if our noses are pressed up against a beautiful painting, perhaps like a fresco, something like that. And our noses are here, and we can edge along the painting if we go, if we try to. But we can't see enough of the painting to get what it is. We know enough to know it must be grand. It must be a glorious design. But we just can't get far enough from it to see it properly and to see how it all fits together. And the right response to our smallness, the right response to our limited perspective, is humility. And it's to humbly rejoice and do good. Look at verse 12. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. Hopefully this is familiar to our ears. We've seen this call to rejoice, to take pleasure in our Creator's generosity already in our first session, and it's going to come up again and again if we read through the book. And once again, we're being challenged to consider this perspective we saw in the first session. You know, life is about gifts more than about gain. It's not the computer game trying to amass the most points we can before the game over. It's an arena where we can receive gifts from a creator so that we can know him and enjoy him better. And in addition to rejoicing in God's gifts, there's also that call in verse 12 to do good. And the point is that although we don't know how God is going to use each of our actions and each of our lives, if we're committing ourselves to him, we can trust that he will. He's weaving all of our experiences, all of our lives, into one glorious story. This is my life's about gifts more than gain thing. He's weaving our lives into one glorious story, and our role is to do good with the opportunities we're given. C.S. Lewis, who remember when I was here, he got probably an outing every Sunday, if not every other, but he's getting an outing today. In his essay, The World's Last Night, he captures it like this. He says, "We do not know the play that we're in. We do not even know whether we're in Act 1 or Act 5. We do not know who are the major and who are the minor characters. The author knows. The audience, if angels and archangels and all the company of heaven fill the pit and the stalls, may have an inkling. But we never see the play from the outside. We never meet any characters except the tiny minority who are on in the same scenes as ourselves. We are wholly ignorant of the future and very imperfectly informed about the past. That the play has a meaning, we may be sure, but we cannot see it. When it is over, the author will have something to say to each of us of the part that each of us has played. The playing it well is what matters infinitely." And Lewis is brilliantly describing there what it means to acknowledge that God is the Lord of time, and we are not. And what it means is that we are to humbly rejoice and do good, and then leave the outcome to him. And not only, I've put on the sheets, are we to rejoice and do good, but we're also to let any frustration lead to worship. And in verse 14, we discover more about God as the master playwright. Verse 14, "I perceive that whatever God does endures forever." God's the artist who's creating this grand and glorious fresco. He's the playwright who not only sees the beginning from the end, but who's weaving every strand of the plot into this one glorious story. And verse 14, "Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it." As mere actors on the stage, we get to play our part. Certainly we do. But ultimately, we don't control the grand plot. That is the playwright's job, not ours. And this tension that we feel, and this chapter does describe that tension, doesn't it? Knowing that there's a big plot, but not knowing what it is, and not knowing how we contribute to it, and knowing that we're not ultimately in control of that great plot. All of that tension, all of that frustration we discover here is deliberate. Why has God done it? Have a look at verse 14 again. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it. Why? So that people fear before him. And that phrase, fear before here, means to fear in God's presence. It means to reverently approach in worship. One of the frustrations God has deliberately placed over this world, when our ancestors first rebelled, is the frustration of not being in control of the seasons of life and discovering that they are ultimately unproductive. And yet God's purpose in that is that we take that frustration and we turn it back into worship. So every time life doesn't go as planned, you know, the macro level, the traffic jam yesterday, the printer paper jam, the mouldy strawberry jam, whatever it was for you, right through to the macro problems, you know, the bereavement, the disability. In fact, every time we sense that this life is out of our control and unproductive, which is pretty often, that is an opportunity. And it's an opportunity for us to say, well, God is in control, not me. He is the Lord of time. He is the great playwright. And these frustrations are deliberate. And they are to remind me who he is and who I am. And my job is just to bow before him and worship him. And this is intensely practical, I think. Grasping these twin truths that we've put there on the slides, rejoice and do good, and let frustration lead to worship, kind of captures all of life. It's such a positive and practical way to live. So if we're receiving blessing right now, you know, if the sun's shining, well, we know what to do. We're to rejoice and we're to do good. Everything we have is from his hand, and it's a gracious gift from him. If we're feeling frustration right now, if we're in the middle of a storm, well, lean into it. It's deliberate. And let it do its work of leading us to acknowledge our smallness and God's greatness so that we can then turn that into worship and dependence. Such a practical teaching in any situation in life. So as we close, the wonderful call of Ecclesiastes 3 is for us to embrace the freedom which comes from accepting that we are limited and finite creatures. In some sense, to give up on being the control freaks that we tend to be, and all the frustration that brings. There's a famous Victorian poem called Invictus. I'm catching the eye of a South African in the corner, and the poem goes like this. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. And there's actually a film about the South African rugby team, which takes the title of that poem, Invictus. And in the film, Mandela presents the poem to the team captain, Francois Pienaar, to inspire him. And that poem, I think, has become something of an anthem for our time. And it suggests that freedom comes from a proud defiance of our creatureliness. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. That's what's being trumpeted and heralded. That's the way to live free. It's a lie. Pretending that I am the Lord over time, when that job is already taken, that is not freedom. That is slavery. That is part of why modern people are so stressed. We're constantly being told to be masters of our fate when that is just beyond our power. M. Scott Peck, in his bestseller, The Road Less Travelled, he put it this way: as soon as we believe that it is possible for a man to become God, we can never rest for long. Never say, okay, my job is done. We must constantly push ourselves to greater and greater wisdom, greater and greater effectiveness. By this belief, we will have trapped ourselves, at least until death, on an effortful treadmill of self-improvement. And he's saying there that much of our stress, much of our relentless busyness comes, and this is the, what this chapter is saying as well, from our failure to distinguish between what should be on God's to-do list and what should be on ours. God's to-do list includes things like planning everything that happens across all of our lives, and deciding when is the time to weep and when is the time to laugh, and all the details of that poem. And it's his job then to weave together all of the scenes of this life into one coherent and glorious whole. And it's his job to ultimately fix every injustice in the world, and so on. God's got a long to-do list. It's vast. I mean, it's expansive. And discovering that that is all on his list is then a great relief to us, because it means that my to-do list is therefore much, much more manageable. So yes, I'm still called to acknowledge my Creator. I'm still called to be thankful for all his gifts in my life. I'm still called to turn my frustrations into worship as I remember that he's God and I'm not. I'm still called to do good. And where we can, we should be putting right injustice and serving God with the gifts that we've been given. But crucially, I am now freed from having to take God's list onto my shoulders as well. And I'm freed at the end of each day to put my tools down and to leave them down. Not always doing one last email, one last job. Because I know that there is a Lord of time, and that he will keep the world spinning very well without my help, and I can rest in him. I guess I was reflecting on this in the last couple of weeks, actually. One of the reasons I think God has invented sleep, isn't it? It's a daily reminder to us that we are not God. We're not like him. It's God who keeps the world turning, during the night hours, not us. And that is a great relief. And actually, each day we are invited to reflect on Ecclesiastes 3's message once again. Every time our head hits the pillow, we can remember he's God and we are not. He's the Lord of time and I can trust him. And incidentally, this call to do good and to serve God with the gifts which I've been given is actually, I think, where the parable which we had at the beginning, the parable of the management consultant and the fisherman, actually might send us off in a wrong direction. If you think about the parable, it's really suggesting that the good life will always be the leisurely life. But if we keep reading on in this book, we're not going to hit every section from it. But in chapter 9, verse 10, we're told, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. This book isn't calling us to laziness. It's actually calling us to trust. And it's as we trust God that we will discover a freedom to embrace the seasons that God puts in our path. All the seasons of that poem. To roll with the rhythms of the poem of life. So if I wake early and I can't get back to sleep, roll with it. Maybe the Lord is opening up an unexpected opportunity to read or read the Bible or to pray or something else. Or if I'm with my daughter and the public transport's not behaving, roll with it. Maybe the Lord's decided it's time for some parent-child time that I hadn't planned. Or if chicken pox has scuppered the family holiday to France that we'd been so looking forward to, well, roll with it. That's an opportunity, isn't it, to reflect as a family on what it is to live in a cursed world and why it is that we're therefore so looking forward to the new world that's coming. And if we're in an unwelcome season right now, an unplanned, an unproductive season, perhaps it's ill health, perhaps it's bereavement, perhaps it's some other struggle, what a difference it makes to know that there is a Lord of time and that he can be fully trusted. There is a great fresco artist. There is a great playwright. There is one who does have an enduring, overarching plan. There is one who will make everything beautiful in its time. And that means we can live our lives trusting him completely. Why don't I close this in prayer, and then Matt's going to jump up and direct us. We do worship you, our Creator God. We worship you that you are the Lord over time. And we do acknowledge that this life is a life of tension and frustration, of knowing that there is great lasting significance to each part of life, and yet not knowing how it all fits together and what you will do with it. Father, please teach us this humility of Ecclesiastes 3. Teach us to be those who rejoice in your good gifts and who do good. And teach us to be those who turn our frustrations back into worship and acknowledge that you are the Lord of time, not us. Please, Father, would these things not just be etchings in our notes today, but would you help us to live these things out in lives of humble worship? We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.